Liesl, in typical fashion, was an onlooker. The argument originated the previous night in the basement, where Hans and Max were sitting with paint cans, words, and drop sheets. Max asked if Rosa might be able to cut his hair at some stage. "It's getting me in the eyes," he'd said, to which Hans had replied, "I'll see what I can do." Now Rosa was riffling through the drawers. Her words were shoved back to Papa with the rest of the junk. "Where are those damn scissors?" "Not in the one below. I've been through that one already." "Maybe you missed them." "Do I look blind?" She raised her head and bellowed, "Liesl!" "I'm right here." Hans cowered. "God damn it, woman. Deafen me, why don't you?" "Quiet, Saukerl!" Rosa went on riffling and addressed the girl. "Liesl, where are the scissors?" But Liesl had no idea either. "Saumensch, you're useless, aren't you? Leave her out of it." More words were delivered back and forth, from elastic-haired woman to silver-eyed man, till Rosa slammed the drawer. "I'll probably make a lot of mistakes on him anyway." "Mistakes?" Papa looked ready to tear his own hair out by that stage, but his voice became a barely audible whisper. "Who the hell's going to see him?" He motioned to speak again, but was distracted by the feathery appearance of Max Vandenberg, who stood politely, embarrassed, in the doorway. He carried his own scissors, and came forward, handing them not to Hans or Rosa, but to the 12-year-old girl. She was the calmest option. His mouth quivered a moment before he said, "Would you?" Liesl took the scissors and opened them. They were rusty and shiny in different areas. She turned to Papa, and when he nodded, she followed Max down to the basement. The Jew sat on a paint can. A small drop sheet was wrapped around his shoulders. "As many mistakes as you want," he told her. Papa parked himself on the steps. Liesl lifted the first tufts of Max Vandenberg's hair. As she cut the feathery strands, she wondered at the sound of scissors. Not the snipping noise, but the grinding of each metal arm as it cropped each group of fibers. When the job was done, a little severe in places, a little crooked in others, she walked upstairs with the hair in her hands and fed it into the stove. She lit a match and watched as the clump shriveled and sank, orange and red. Again, Max was in the doorway, this time at the top of the basement steps. "Thanks, Liesl." His voice was tall and husky, with a sound in it of a hidden smile. No sooner had he spoken than he disappeared again, back into the ground. 2. The newspaper. Early May. "There's a Jew in my basement. There's a Jew in my basement." Sitting on the floor of the mayor's room full of books, Liesl Memminger heard those words. A bag of washing was at her side, and the ghostly figure of the mayor's wife was sitting hunch-drunk over the desk. In front of her, Liesl read The Whistler, pages 22 and 23. She looked up. She imagined herself walking over, gently tearing some fluffy hair to the side, and whispering in the woman's ear, "There's a Jew in my basement." As the book quivered in her lap, the secret sat in her mouth. It made itself comfortable. It crossed its legs. "I should be getting home." This time she actually spoke. Her hands were shaking. Despite a trace of sunshine in the distance, a gentle breeze rode through the open window, coupled with rain that came in like sawdust. When Liesl placed the book back into position, the woman's chair stubbed the floor, and she made her way over. It was always like this at the end. The gentle rings of sorrowful wrinkles swelled a moment as she reached across and retrieved the book. She offered it to the girl. Liesl shied away. "No," she said, "thank you. I have enough books at home. Maybe another time? I'm rereading something else with my papa. You know, the one I stole from the fire that night?" The mayor's wife nodded. If there was one thing about Liesl Memminger, her thieving was not gratuitous. She only stole books on what she felt was a need-to-have basis. Currently, she had enough. She'd gone through the mud men 4 times now, and was enjoying her reacquaintance with the shoulder shrug. Also, each night before bed, she would open a fail-safe guide to grave-digging. Buried deep inside it, the standover man resided. She mouthed the words and touched the birds. She turned the noisy pages, slowly.
"Goodbye, Frau Herrmann."
She exited the library, walked down the floorboard hall and out the monstrous doorway. As was her habit, she stood for a while on the steps, looking at mulking beneath her. The town that afternoon was covered in a yellow mist, which stroked the rooftops as if they were pets, and filled up the streets like a bath. When she made it down to Munich Street, the book thief swerved in and out of the umbrellaed men and women, a rain-cloaked girl who made her way without shame from one garbage can to another, like clockwork.
There!
She laughed up at the coppery clouds, celebrating before reaching in and taking the mangled newspaper. Although the front and back pages were streaked with black tears of print, she folded it neatly in half and tucked it under her arm. It had been like this each Thursday for the past few months. Thursday was the only delivery day left for Liesl Memminger now, and it was usually able to provide some sort of dividend. She could never dampen the feeling of victory each time she found a mulking express or any other publication. Finding a newspaper was a good day. If it was a paper in which the crossword wasn't done, it was a great day. She would make her way home, shut the door behind her, and take it down to Max Vandenberg. "Crossword?" he would ask.
"Empty." "Excellent."
The Jew would smile as he accepted the package of paper and started reading in the rationed light of the basement. Often, Liesl would watch him as he focused on reading the paper, completed the crossword, and then started to reread it, front to back. With the weather warming, Max remained downstairs all the time. During the day, the basement door was left open to allow the small bay of daylight to reach him from the corridor. The hall itself was not exactly bathed in sunshine, but in certain situations, you take what you can get. Dour light was better than none, and they needed to be frugal. The kerosene had not yet approached a dangerously low level, but it was best to keep its usage to a minimum. Liesl would usually sit on some drop sheets. She would read, while Max completed those crosswords. They sat a few meters apart, speaking very rarely, and there was really only the noise of turning pages. Often, she also left her books for Max to read while she was at school. Where Hans Hubermann and Eric Vandenberg were ultimately united by music, Max and Liesl were held together by the quiet gathering of words.
"Hi, Max."
"Hi, Liesl."
They would sit and read. At times, she would watch him. She decided that he could best be summed up as a picture of pale concentration. Beige-colored skin, a swamp in each eye, and he breathed like a fugitive, desperate yet soundless. It was only his chest that gave him away for something alive. Increasingly, Liesl would close her eyes and ask Max to quiz her on the words she was continually getting wrong, and she would swear if they still escaped her. She would then stand and paint those words to the wall, anywhere up to 12 times. Together, Max Vandenberg and Liesl Memminger would take in the odor of paint fumes and cement.
"Bye, Max."
"Bye, Liesl."
In bed, she would lie awake, imagining him below in the basement. In her bedtime visions, he always slept fully clothed, shoes included, just in case he needed to flee again. He slept with one eye open. 3. The Weatherman, mid-May. Liesl opened the door and her mouth simultaneously. On Himmel Street, her team had trounced Rudy 6-1, and triumphant, she burst into the kitchen, telling Mama and Papa all about the goal she'd scored. She then rushed down to the basement to describe it blow by blow to Max, who put down his newspaper and intently listened and laughed with the girl. When the story of the goal was complete, there was silence for a good few minutes, until Max slowly looked up. Would you do something for me, Liesl? Still excited by her Himmel Street goal, the girl jumped from the drop sheets. She did not say it, but her movement clearly showed her intent to provide exactly what he wanted.
You told me all about the goal, he said, but I don't know what sort of day it is up there. I don't know if you scored it in the sun or if the clouds have covered everything.
His hand prodded at his short cropped hair, and his swampy eyes pleaded for the simplest of simple things. Could you go up and tell me how the weather looks? Naturally, Liesl hurried up the stairs. She stood a few feet from the spit-stained door and turned on the spot, observing the sky. When she returned to the basement, she told him,
The sky is blue today, Max, and there's a big, long cloud, and it's stretched out like a rope. At the end of it, the sun is like a yellow hole.
Max, at that moment, knew that only a child could have given him a weather report like that. On the wall, he painted a long, tightly knotted rope with a dripping yellow sun at the end of it, as if you could dive right into it. On the ropey cloud, he drew two figures, a thin girl and a withering Jew, and they were walking, arms balanced, toward that dripping sun. Beneath the picture, he wrote the following sentence. The wall-written words of Max Vandenberg. It was a Monday, and they walked on a tightrope to the sun. 4. The Boxer. End of May. For Max Vandenberg, there was cool cement and plenty of time to spend with it. The minutes were cruel. Hours were punishing. Standing above him at all moments of awakeness was the hand of time, and it didn't hesitate to wring him out. It smiled and squeezed and let him live. What great malice there could be in allowing something to live. At least once a day, Hans Hubermann would descend the basement steps and share a conversation. Rosa would occasionally bring a spare crust of bread. It was when Liesl came down, however, that Max found himself most interested in life again. Initially, he tried to resist, but it was harder every day that the girl appeared, each time with a new weather report, either of pure blue sky, cardboard clouds, or a sun that had broken through like God sitting down after he'd eaten too much for his dinner. When he was alone, his most distinct feeling was of disappearance. All of his clothes were grey, whether they'd started out that way or not, from his pants to his woolen sweater to the jacket that dripped from him now like water. He often checked if his skin was flaking, for it was as if he were dissolving. What he needed was a series of new projects. The first was exercise. He started with push-ups, lying stomach down on the cool basement floor, then hoisting himself up. It felt like his arms snapped at each elbow, and he envisaged his heart seeping out of him and dropping pathetically to the ground. As a teenager in Stuttgart, he could reach 50 push-ups at a time. Now at the age of 24, perhaps 15 pounds lighter than his usual weight, he could barely make it to 10. After a week, he was completing 3 sets each of 16 push-ups and 22 sit-ups. When he was finished, he would sit against the basement wall with his paint can friends, feeling his pulse in his teeth. His muscles felt like cake. He wondered at times if pushing himself like this was even worth it. Sometimes, though, when his heartbeat neutralized and his body became functional again, he would turn off the lamp and stand in the darkness of the basement. He was 24, but he could still fantasize.
In the blue corner, he quietly commentated, we have the champion of the world, the Aryan masterpiece, the Führer. He breathed and turned. And in the red corner, we have the Jewish rat-faced challenger, Max Vandenberg.
Around him, it all materialized. White light lowered itself into a boxing ring, and a crowd stood and murmured, that magical sound of many people talking all at once. How could every person there have so much to say at the same time? The ring itself was perfect. Perfect canvas, lovely ropes,
Even the stray hairs of each thickened string were flawless, gleaming in the tight white light. The room smelled like cigarettes and beer.
Diagonally across, Adolf Hitler stood in the corner with his entourage. His legs poked out from a red and white robe with a black swastika burned into its back. His moustache was knitted to his face. Words were whispered to him from his trainer, Goebbels. He bounced foot to foot, and he smiled. He smiled loudest when the ring announcer listed his many achievements, which were all vociferously applauded by the adoring crowd.
"Undefeated," the ringmaster proclaimed, "over many a Jew and over any other threat to the German ideal. Herr Führer," he concluded, "we salute you."
The crowd. Mayhem. Next, when everyone had settled down, came the challenger. The ringmaster swung over toward Max, who stood alone in the challenger's corner. No robe, no entourage. Just a lonely young Jew with dirty breath, a naked chest, and tired hands and feet. Naturally, his shorts were grey. He, too, moved from foot to foot, but it was kept at a minimum to conserve energy. He'd done a lot of sweating in the gym to make the weight.
"The challenger," sang the ringmaster, "of,"
and he paused for effect,
"Jewish blood."
The crowd oohed like human ghouls.
"Weighing in at..."
The rest of the speech was not heard. It was overrun with the abuse from the bleachers, and Max watched as his opponent was derobed and came to the middle to hear the rules and shake hands.
"Guten Tag, Herr Hitler,"
Max nodded, but the Führer only showed him his yellow teeth, then covered them up again with his lips.
"Gentlemen,"
a stout referee in black pants and a blue shirt began. A bow tie was fixed to his throat.
"First and foremost, we want a good, clean fight."
He addressed only the Führer now.
"Unless, of course, Herr Hitler, you begin to lose. Should this occur, I will be quite willing to turn a blind eye to any unconscionable tactics you might employ to grind this piece of Jewish stench and filth into the canvas."
He nodded with great courtesy.
"Is that clear?"
The Führer spoke his first word then.
"Christel!"
To Max, the referee extended a warning.
"As for you, my Jewish chump, I'd watch my step very closely if I were you. Very closely indeed."
And they were sent back to their respective corners. A brief quiet ensued. The bell. First out was the Führer, awkward-legged and bony, running at Max and jabbing him firmly in the face. The crowd vibrated, the bells still in their ears, and their satisfied smiles hurdled the ropes. The smoky breath of Hitler steamed from his mouth as his hands bucked at Max's face, collecting him several times on the lips, the nose, the chin, and Max had still not ventured out of his corner. To absorb the punishment, he held up his hands, but the Führer then aimed at his ribs, his kidneys, his lungs. Oh, the eyes, the Führer's eyes! They were so deliciously brown, like Jews' eyes, and they were so determined that even Max stood transfixed for a moment as he caught sight of them between the healthy blur of punching gloves. There was only one round, and it lasted hours, and for the most part, nothing changed. The Führer pounded away at the punching bag Jew. Jewish blood was everywhere, like red rain clouds on the white sky canvas at their feet. Eventually, Max's knees began to buckle, his cheekbones silently moaned, and the Führer's delighted face still chipped away, until depleted, beaten, and broken. The Jew flopped to the floor. First a roar, then silence. The referee counted. He had a gold tooth and a plethora of nostril hair. Slowly, Max Vandenberg, the Jew, rose to his feet and made himself upright. His voice wobbled. An invitation.
"Come on, Führer," he said,
and this time, when Adolf Hitler set upon his Jewish counterpart, Max stepped aside and plunged him into the corner. He punched him 7 times, aiming on each occasion for only one thing.
the moustache.
With the seventh punch, he missed. It was the Führer's chin that sustained the blow. All at once, Hitler hit the ropes and creased forward, landing on his knees. This time, there was no count. The referee flinched in the corner. The audience sank down back to their beer. On his knees, the Führer tested himself for blood and straightened his hair, right to left. When he returned to his feet, much to the approval of the thousand-strong crowd, he edged forward and did something quite strange. He turned his back on the Jew and took the gloves from his fists. The crowd was stunned.
"He's given up," someone whispered.
But within moments, Adolf Hitler was standing on the ropes, and he was addressing the arena.
"My fellow Germans," he called, "you can see something here tonight, can't you?"
Bare-chested, victory-eyed, he pointed over at Max.
"You can see that what we face is something far more sinister and powerful than we ever imagined. Can you see that?"
They answered, "Yes, Führer."
"Can you see that this enemy has found its ways, its despicable ways, through our armor, and that clearly I cannot stand up here alone and fight him?"
The words were visible. They dropped from his mouth like jewels.
"Look at him. Take a good look."
They looked at the bloodied Max Vandenberg.
"As we speak, he is plotting his way into your neighborhood. He's moving in next door. He's infesting you with his family, and he's about to take you over. He..."
Hitler glanced at him a moment with disgust.
"He will soon own you, until it is he who stands not at the counter of your grocery shop, but sits in the back, smoking his pipe. Before you know it, you'll be working for him at minimum wage, while he can hardly walk from the weight in his pockets. Will you simply stand there and let him do this? Will you stand by as your leaders did in the past, when they gave your land to everybody else, when they sold your country for the price of a few signatures? Will you stand out there powerless? Or..."
And now he stepped one rung higher.
"Will you climb up into this ring with me?"
Max shook. Horror stuttered in his stomach. Adolf finished him.
"Will you climb in here so that we can defeat this enemy together?"
In the basement of 33 Himmel Street, Max Vandenberg could feel the fists of an entire nation. One by one, they climbed into the ring and beat him down. They made him bleed. They let him suffer. Millions of them. Until one last time, when he gathered himself to his feet. He watched the next person climb through the ropes. It was a girl, and as she slowly crossed the canvas, he noticed a tear torn down her left cheek. In her right hand was a newspaper.
"The crossword," she gently said, "is empty."
And she held it out to him. Dark. Nothing but dark now. Just basement. Just Jew. 5. The New Dream. A few nights later. It was afternoon. Liesel came down the basement steps. Max was halfway through his push-ups. She watched a while without his knowledge, and when she came and sat with him, he stood up and leaned back against the wall. "Did I tell you," he asked her, "that I've been having a new dream lately?" Liesel shifted a little to see his face. "But I dream this when I'm awake." He motioned to the glowless kerosene lamp. "Sometimes I turn out the light. Then I stand here and wait."
"For what?"
Max corrected her. "Not for what. For whom?" For a few moments, Liesel said nothing. It was one of those conversations that require some time to elapse between exchanges.
"Who do you wait for?"
Max did not move. "The Führer." He was very matter-of-fact about this. "That's why I'm in training."
"The push-ups?"
"That's right." He walked to the concrete stairway. "Every night, I wait in the dark, and the Führer comes down these steps. He walks down, and he and I, we fight
for hours. Liesel was standing now. Who wins? At first he was going to answer that no one did, but then he noticed the paint cans, the drop sheets, and the growing pile of newspapers in the periphery of his vision. He watched the words, the long cloud, and the figures on the wall. "I do," he said. It was as though he'd opened her palm, given her the words, and closed it up again. Under the ground in Mulking, Germany, two people stood and spoke in a basement. It sounds like the beginning of a joke. There's a Jew and a German standing in a basement, right? This, however, was no joke. 6. The Painters. Early June. Another of Max's projects was the remainder of Mein Kampf. Each page was gently stripped from the book and laid out on the floor to receive a coat of paint. It was then hung up to dry and replaced between the front and back covers. When Liesel came down one day after school, she found Max, Rosa, and her papa all painting the various pages. Many of them were already hanging from a drawn-out string with pegs, just as they must have done for the standover man. All three people looked up and spoke. "Hi, Liesel."
"Here's a brush, Liesel."
"About time, Zalmensch. Where have you been so long?"
As she started painting, Liesel thought about Max Vandenberg fighting the Führer, exactly as he'd explained it. Basement Visions, June 1941. Punches are thrown, the crowd climbs out of the walls. Max and the Führer fight for their lives, each rebounding off the stairway. There's blood in the Führer's moustache, as well as in his part line on the right side of his head. "Come on, Führer," says the Jew. He waves him forward. "Come on, Führer." When the visions dissipated and she finished her first page, Papa winked at her. Mama castigated her for hogging the paint. Max examined each and every page, perhaps watching what he planned to produce on them. Many months later, he would also paint over the cover of that book and give it a new title after one of the stories he would write and illustrate inside it. That afternoon, in the secret ground below 33 Himmel Street, the Hubermans, Liesel Memminger, and Max Vandenberg prepared the pages of the Word Shaker. It felt good to be a painter. 7. The Showdown, June the 24th. Then came the seventh side of the die. 2 days after Germany invaded Russia, 3 days before Britain and the Soviets joined forces. 7. You roll and watch it coming, realizing completely that this is no regular die. You claim it to be bad luck, but you've known all along that it had to come. You brought it into the room. The table could smell it on your breath. The Jew was sticking out of your pocket from the outset. He's smeared to your lapel, and the moment you roll, you know it's a 7. The one thing that somehow finds a way to hurt you. It lands. It stares you in each eye, miraculous and loathsome, and you turn away with it feeding on your chest. "Just bad luck," that's what you say. "Of no consequence." That's what you make yourself believe, because deep down you know that this small piece of changing fortune is a signal of things to come. You hide a Jew, you pay. Somehow or other, you must. In hindsight, Liesel told herself that it was not such a big deal. Perhaps it was because so much more had happened by the time she wrote her story in the basement. In the great scheme of things, she reasoned that Rosa being fired by the mayor and his wife was not bad luck at all. It had nothing whatsoever to do with hiding Jews. It had everything to do with the greater context of the war. At the time, though, there was most definitely a feeling of punishment. The beginning was actually a week or so earlier than June the 24th. Liesel scavenged a newspaper for Max Vandenberg, as she always did. She reached into a garbage can just off Munich Street and tucked it under her arm. Once she delivered it to Max and he'd commenced his first reading, he glanced across at her and pointed to a picture on the front page. "Isn't this Whose Washing and Ironing You Deliver?" Liesel came over from the wall.
She'd been writing the word argument 6 times, next to Max's picture of the ropey cloud and the dripping sun. Max handed her the paper, and she confirmed it.
That's him.
When she went on to read the article, Heinz Hermann, the mayor, was quoted as saying that although the war was progressing splendidly, the people of Molking, like all responsible Germans, should take adequate measures and prepare for the possibility of harder times.
You never know, he stated, what our enemies are thinking, or how they will try to debilitate us.
A week later, the mayor's words came to nasty fruition. Liesel, as she always did, showed up at Granderstrasse and read from the Whistler on the floor of the mayor's library. The mayor's wife showed no signs of abnormality, or, let's be frank, no additional signs, until it was time to leave. This time, when she offered Liesel the Whistler, she insisted on the girl taking it.
Please,
she almost begged. The book was held out in a tight, measured fist.
Take it, please.
Take it. Liesel, touched by the strangeness of this woman, couldn't bear to disappoint her again. The grey-covered book, with its yellowing pages, found its way into her hand, and she began to walk the corridor. As she was about to ask for the washing, the mayor's wife gave her a final look of bathrobed sorrow. She reached into the chest of drawers and withdrew an envelope. Her voice, lumpy from lack of use, coughed out the words.
I'm sorry. It's for your mama.
Liesel stopped breathing. She was suddenly aware of how empty her feet felt inside her shoes. Something ridiculed her throat. She trembled. When finally she reached out and took possession of the letter, she noticed the sound of the clock in the library. Grimly, she realized that clocks don't make a sound that even remotely resembles ticking, talking. It was more the sound of a hammer, upside down, hacking methodically at the earth. It was the sound of a grave. If only mine was ready now, she thought, because Liesel Memminger, at that moment, wanted to die. When the others had cancelled, it hadn't hurt so much. There was always the mayor, his library, and her connection with his wife. Also, this was the last one, the last hope, gone. This time, it felt like the greatest betrayal. How could she face her mama? For Rosa, the few scraps of money had still helped in various alleyways. An extra handful of flour, a piece of fat. Ilse Hermann was dying now herself, to get rid of her. Liesel could see it somewhere in the way she hugged the robe a little tighter. The clumsiness of sorrow still kept her at close proximity, but clearly she wanted this to be over.
Tell your mama,
she spoke again. Her voice was adjusting now as one sentence turned into two. That we're sorry. She started shepherding the girl toward the door. Liesel felt it now in the shoulders, the pain, the impact of final rejection. That's it? She asked internally. You just boot me out. Slowly, she picked up her empty bag and edged toward the door. Once outside, she turned and faced the mayor's wife for the second to last time that day. She looked her in the eyes with an almost savage brand of pride.
Danke schön, she said,
and Ilse Hermann smiled in a rather useless, beaten way.
If you ever want to come just to read, the woman lied,
or at least the girl, in her shocked, saddened state, perceived it as a lie.
You're very welcome.
At that moment, Liesel was amazed by the width of the doorway. There was so much space. Why did people need so much space to get through the door? Had Rudy been there, he'd have called her an idiot. It was to get all their stuff inside.
Goodbye,
the girl said, and slowly, with great morosity, the door was closed. Liesel did not leave. For a long time, she sat on the steps and watched Molking. It was neither warm nor cool, and the town was clear and still. Molking was in a jar. She opened the letter. In it, Mayor Heinz Hermann diplomatically outlined exactly why he had to terminate the services of Rosa Huberman. For the most part, he explained that he would be a hypocrite if he maintained his own small luxuries while advising others to prepare for harder times. When she eventually stood and walked home, her moment of reaction came once again when she saw the Steiner Schneider Meister sign on Munich Street. Her sadness left her, and she was overwhelmed with anger.
"That bastard mayor," she whispered. "That pathetic woman."
The fact that harder times were coming was surely the best reason for keeping Rosa employed, but no, they fired her. At any rate, she decided, they could do their own blasted washing and ironing, like normal people. Like poor people. In her hand, the whistler tightened.
"So you give me the book," the girl said, "for pity, to make yourself feel better."
The fact that she'd also been offered the book prior to that day mattered little. She turned, as she had once before, and marched back to 8 Grunderstrasse. The temptation to run was immense, but she refrained so that she'd have enough in reserve for the words. When she arrived, she was disappointed that the mayor himself was not there. No car was slotted nicely on the side of the road, which was perhaps a good thing. Had it been there, there was no telling what she might have done to it, in this moment of rich versus poor. 2 steps at a time, she reached the door and banged it hard enough to hurt. She enjoyed the small fragments of pain. Evidently, the mayor's wife was shocked when she saw her again. Her fluffy hair was slightly wet, and her wrinkles widened when she noticed the obvious fury on Liesel's usually pallid face. She opened her mouth, but nothing came out, which was handy, really, for it was Liesel who possessed the talking.
"You think," she said, "you can buy me off with this book?"
Her voice, though shaken, hooked at the woman's throat. The glittering anger was thick and unnerving, but she toiled through it. She worked herself up even further, to the point where she needed to wipe the tears from her eyes.
"You give me this sowmensch of a book and think it'll make everything good when I go and tell my mama that we've just lost our last one, while you sit here in your mansion?"
The mayor's wife's arms. They hung. Her face slipped. Liesel, however, did not buckle. She sprayed her words directly into the woman's eyes.
"You and your husband sitting up here?"
Now she became spiteful. More spiteful and evil than she thought herself capable. The injury of words. Yes, the brutality of words. She summoned them from some place she only now recognized and hurled them at Ilse Hermann.
"It's about time," she informed her, "that you do your own stinking washing anyway. It's about time you face the fact that your son is dead. He got killed. He got strangled and cut up more than 20 years ago. Or did he freeze to death? Either way, he's dead. He's dead, and it's pathetic that you sit here shivering in your own house to suffer for it. You think you're the only one?"
Immediately, her brother was next to her. He whispered for her to stop, but he too was dead, and not worth listening to. He died in a train. They buried him in the snow. Liesel glanced at him, but she could not make herself stop, not yet.
"This book," she went on. She shoved the boy down the steps, making him fall. "I don't want it."
The words were quieter now, but still just as hot. She threw the whistler at the woman's slippered feet, hearing the clack of it as it landed on the cement.
"I don't want your miserable book!"
Now she managed it. She fell silent. Her throat was barren now. No words for miles. Her brother, holding his knee, disappeared. After a miscarriaged pause, the mayor's wife edged forward and picked up the book. She was battered and beaten up, and not from smiling this time. Liesel could see it on her face. Blood leaked from her nose and licked at her lips. Her eyes had blackened. Cuts had opened up, and a series of wounds were rising to the surface of her skin, all from the words, from Liesel's words. Book in hand, and straightening from a crouch to a standing hunch, Ilse Hermann began the process again of saying sorry, but the sentence did not make it out.
"Slap me,"
Liesel thought. Come on, slap me. Ilse Hermann didn't slap her. She merely retreated backward into the ugly air of her beautiful house, and Liesel, once again, was left alone, clutching at the steps. She was afraid to turn around because she knew that when she did, the glass casing of Mulking had now been shattered, and she'd be glad of it. As her last orders of business, she read the letter one more time, and when she was close to the gate, she screwed it up as tightly as she could and threw it at the door as if it were a rock. I have no idea what the book thief expected, but the ball of paper hit the mighty sheet of wood and twittered back down the steps. It landed at her feet. Typical, she stated, kicking it onto the grass. Useless. On the way home this time, she imagined the fate of that paper the next time it rained, when the mended glass house of Mulking was turned upside down. She could already see the words dissolving letter by letter, till there was nothing left. Just paper. Just earth. At home, as luck would have it, when Liesel walked through the door, Rosa was in the kitchen. "Ant?" she asked. "Where's the washing?"
"No washing today," Liesel told her.
Rosa came and sat down at the kitchen table. She knew. Suddenly, she appeared much older. Liesel imagined what she'd look like if she untied her bun to let it fall out onto her shoulders. A grey towel of elastic hair.
"What did you do there, you little Zalmensch?"
The sentence was numb. She could not muster her usual venom.
"It was my fault," Liesel answered. "Completely. I insulted the mayor's wife and told her to stop crying over her dead son. I called her pathetic. That was when they fired you. Here."
She walked to the wooden spoons, grabbed a handful, and placed them in front of her.
"Take your pick."
Rosa touched one and picked it up, but she did not wield it.
"I don't believe you."
Liesel was torn between distress and total mystification. The one time she desperately wanted a Watschen, and she couldn't get one.
"It's my fault."
"It's not your fault," Mama said, and she even stood and stroked Liesel's waxy, unwashed hair.
"I know you wouldn't say those things."
"I said them."
"All right, you said them."
As Liesel left the room, she could hear the wooden spoons clicking back into position in the metal jar that held them. By the time she reached her bedroom, the whole lot of them, the jar included, were thrown to the floor. Later, she walked down to the basement where Max was standing in the dark, most likely boxing with a Führer.
"Max?"
The light dimmed on, a red coin floating in the corner.
"Can you teach me how to do the push-ups?"
Max showed her and occasionally lifted her torso to help, but despite her bony appearance, Liesel was strong and could hold her body weight nicely. She didn't count how many she could do, but that night, in the glow of the basement, the book thief completed enough push-ups to make her hurt for several days. Even when Max advised her that she'd already done too many, she continued. In bed, she read with Papa, who could tell something was wrong. It was the first time in a month that he'd come in and sat with her, and she was comforted, if only slightly. Somehow, Hans Hubermann always knew what to say, when to stay, and when to leave her be. Perhaps Liesel was the one thing he was a true expert at.
"Is it the washing?" he asked.
Liesel shook her head. Papa hadn't shaved for a few days, and he rubbed the scratchy whiskers every 2 or 3 minutes. His silver eyes were flat and calm, slightly warm, as they always were when it came to Liesel. When the reading petered out, Papa fell asleep. It was then that Liesel spoke what she'd wanted to say all along.
"Papa," she whispered, "I think I'm going to hell."
Her legs were warm, her knees were cold. She remembered the nights when she'd wet the bed, and Papa had washed the sheets, and taught her the letters of the alphabet. Now his breathing blew across the blanket, and she kissed his scratchy cheek.
"You need a shave," she said.
"You're not going to hell," Papa replied.
For a few moments,
She watched his face. Then she lay back down, leaned on him, and together they slept, very much in Munich, but somewhere on the seventh side of Germany's die. Rudy's youth. In the end, she had to give it to him. He knew how to perform. A portrait of Rudi Steiner, July 1941. Strings of mud clench his face. His tie is a pendulum long dead in its clock. His lemon, lamp-lit hair is disheveled, and he wears a sad, absurd smile. He stood a few meters from the step and spoke with great conviction, great joy.
"Alles ist scheiße," he announced. "All is shit."
In the first half of 1941, while Liesel went about the business of concealing Max Vandenberg, stealing newspapers, and telling off Mayer's wives, Rudi was enduring a new life of his own at the Hitler Youth. Since early February, he'd been returning from the meetings in a considerably worse state than he'd left in. On many of those return trips, Tommy Müller was by his side, in the same condition. The trouble had three elements to it. A triple-tiered problem. 1. Tommy Müller's ears. 2. Franz Deutscher, the irate Hitler Youth leader. 3. Rudi's inability to stay out of things. If only Tommy Müller hadn't disappeared for 7 hours on one of the coldest days in Munich's history 6 years earlier. His ear infections and nerve damage were still contorting the marching pattern at the Hitler Youth, which I can assure you was not a positive thing. To begin with, the downward slide of momentum was gradual, but as the months progressed, Tommy was consistently gathering the ire of the Hitler Youth leaders, especially when it came to the marching. Remember Hitler's birthday the previous year? For some time, the ear infections were getting worse. They had reached the point where Tommy had genuine problems hearing. He could not make out the commands that were shouted at the group as they marched in line. It didn't matter if it was in the hall or outside, in the snow or the mud or the slits of rain. The goal was always to have everyone stop at the same time. "One click," they were told. "That's all the Führer wants to hear. Everyone united. Everyone together as one." Then Tommy. It was his left ear, I think. That was the most troublesome of the two, and when the bitter cry of "Halt!" wet the ears of everybody else, Tommy marched comically and obliviously on. He could transform a marching line into a dog's breakfast in the blink of an eye. On one particular Saturday at the beginning of July, just after 3:30, and a litany of Tommy-inspired failed marching attempts, Franz Deutscher, the ultimate name for the ultimate teenage Nazi, was completely fed up. "Müller, du Affe!" His thick blonde hair massaged his head, and his words manipulated Tommy's face. "You ape! What's wrong with you?" Tommy slouched fearfully back, but his left cheek still managed to twitch in a manic, cheerful contortion. He appeared not only to be laughing with a triumphant smirk, but accepting the bucketing with glee. And Franz Deutscher wasn't having any of it. His pale eyes cooked him. "Well," he asked, "what can you say for yourself?" Tommy's twitch only increased in both speed and depth. "Are you mocking me?" "Heil," twitched Tommy, in a desperate attempt to buy some approval, but he did not make it to the Hitler part. That was when Rudi stepped forward. He faced Franz Deutscher, looking up at him. "He's got a problem, sir."
"I can see that."
"With his ears," Rudi finished. "He can't..."
"Right, that's it."
Deutscher rubbed his hands together.
"Both of you, 6 laps of the grounds."
They obeyed, but not fast enough.
"Schnell!"
His voice chased them. When the 6 laps were completed, they were given some drills of the run, drop down, get up, get down again variety, and after 15 very long minutes, they were ordered to the ground for what should have been the last time. Rudi looked down. A warped circle of mud grinned up at him. "What might you be looking at?" it seemed to ask. "Down," Franz ordered. Rudy naturally jumped over it and dropped to his stomach. "Up," Franz smiled. "One step back." They did it. "Down." The message was clear, and now Rudy accepted it. He dived at the mud and held his breath, and at that moment, lying ear to sodden earth, the drill ended. "Vielen Dank, meine Herren," Franz Deutscher politely said. "Many thanks, my gentlemen." Rudy climbed to his knees, did some gardening in his ear, and looked across at Tommy. Tommy closed his eyes, and he twitched. When they returned to Himmel Street that day, Liesel was playing hopscotch with some of the younger kids, still in her BDM uniform. From the corner of her eye, she saw the two melancholic figures walking toward her. One of them called out. They met on the front step of the Steiner's concrete shoebox of a house, and Rudy told her all about the day's episode. After 10 minutes, Liesel sat down. After 11 minutes, Tommy, who was sitting next to her, said, "It's all my fault." But Rudy waved him away somewhere between sentence and smile, chopping a mud streak in half with his finger. "It's my—" Tommy tried again, but Rudy broke the sentence completely and pointed at him. "Tommy, please." There was a peculiar look of contentment on Rudy's face. Liesel had never seen someone so miserable, yet so wholeheartedly alive. "Just sit there and twitch or something." And he continued with the story. He paced. He wrestled his tie. The words were flung at her, landing somewhere on the concrete step. "That Deutscher," he summed up buoyantly. "He got us, huh, Tommy?" Tommy nodded, twitched, and spoke, not necessarily in that order.
"It was because of me."
"Tommy, what did I say?"
"When?"
"Now. Just keep quiet."
"Sure, Rudy."
When Tommy walked forlornly home a short while later, Rudy tried what appeared to be a masterful new tactic. Pity. On the step, he perused the mud that had dried as a crusty sheet on his uniform, then looked Liesel hopelessly in the face.
"What about it, Sir Mensch?"
"What about what?"
"You know,"
Liesel responded in the usual fashion.
"Saukerl,"
she laughed, and she walked the short distance home. A disconcerting mixture of mud and pity was one thing, but kissing Rudi Steiner was something entirely different. Smiling sadly on the step, he called out, rummaging a hand through his hair.
"One day," he warned her. "One day, Liesel."
In the basement, just over 2 years later, Liesel ached sometimes to go next door and see him, even if she was writing in the early hours of morning. She also realized it was most likely those sodden days of the Hitler Youth that had fed his, and subsequently her own, desire for crime. After all, despite the usual bouts of rain, summer was beginning to arrive properly. The Klar apples should have been ripening. There was more stealing to be done. The Losers. When it came to stealing, Liesel and Rudy first stuck with the idea that there was safety in numbers. Andy Schmeichel invited them to the river for a meeting. Among other things, a game plan for fruit stealing would be on the agenda.
"So are you the leader now?"
Rudy had asked, but Andy shook his head, heavy with disappointment. He clearly wished that he had what it took.
"No."
His cool voice was unusually warm, half-baked.
"There's someone else."
The new Arthur Berg. He had windy hair and cloudy eyes, and he was the kind of delinquent who had no other reason to steal except that he enjoyed it. His name was Victor Chemmel. Unlike most people engaged in the various arts of thievery, Victor Chemmel had it all. He lived in the best part of Malking, high up in a villa that had been fumigated when the Jews were driven out. He had money. He had cigarettes. What he wanted, however, was more.
No crime in wanting a little more, he claimed, lying back in the grass with a collection of boys assembled around him.
Wanting more is our fundamental right as Germans. What does our Führer say? He answered his own rhetoric. We must take what is rightfully ours. At face value, Victor Chemmel was clearly your typical teenage bullshit artist. Unfortunately, when he felt like revealing it, he also possessed a certain charisma, a kind of follow me. When Liesl and Rudy approached the group by the river, she heard him ask another question.
So where are these two deviants you've been bragging about? It's 4:10 already.
Not by my watch, said Rudy. Victor Chemmel propped himself up on an elbow.
You're not wearing a watch.
Would I be here if I was rich enough to own a watch?
The new leader sat up fully and smiled with straight white teeth. He then turned his casual focus onto the girl.
Who's the little whore?
Liesl, well accustomed to verbal abuse, simply watched the fog-written texture of his eyes.
Last year, she listed, I stole at least 300 apples and dozens of potatoes. I have little trouble with barbed wire fences, and I can keep up with anyone here.
Is that right?
Yes.
She did not shrink or step away.
All I ask is a small part of anything we take. A dozen apples here or there, a few leftovers for me and my friend.
Well, I suppose that can be arranged.
Victor lit a cigarette and raised it to his mouth. He made a concerted effort to blow his next mouthful in Liesl's face. Liesl did not cough. It was the same group as the previous year, the only exception being the leader. Liesl wondered why none of the other boys had assumed the helm, but looking from face to face, she realized that none of them had it. They had no qualms about stealing, but they needed to be told. They liked to be told, and Victor Chemmel liked to be the teller. It was a nice microcosm. For a moment, Liesl longed for the reappearance of Arthur Berg. Or would he too have fallen under the leadership of Chemmel? It didn't matter. Liesl only knew that Arthur Berg did not have a tyrannical bone in his body, whereas the new leader had hundreds of them. Last year, she knew that if she was stuck in a tree, Arthur would come back for her, despite claiming otherwise. This year, by comparison, she was instantly aware that Victor Chemmel wouldn't even bother to look back. He stood, regarding the lanky boy and the malnourished-looking girl.
So, you want to steal with me?
What did they have to lose? They nodded. He stepped closer and grabbed Rudy's hair.
I want to hear it.
Definitely,
Rudy said, before being shoved back, fringe first.
And you?
Of course.
Liesl was quick enough to avoid the same treatment. Victor smiled. He squashed his cigarette, breathed deeply in, and scratched his chest.
My gentleman? My whore? It looks like it's time to go shopping.
As the group walked off, Liesl and Rudy were at the back as they'd always been in the past.
Do you like him?
Rudy whispered.
Do you?
Rudy paused a moment.
I think he's a complete bastard. Me too.
The group was getting away from them.
Come on, Rudy said. We've fallen behind.
After a few miles, they reached the first farm. What greeted them was a shock. The trees they'd imagined to be swollen with fruit were frail and injured-looking, with only a small array of apples hanging miserly from each branch. The next farm was the same. Maybe it was a bad season, or their timing wasn't quite right. By the end of the afternoon, when the spoils were handed out, Liesl and Rudy were given one diminutive apple between them. In fairness, the takings were incredibly poor, but Victor Chemmel also ran a tighter ship.
What do you call this?
Rudy asked, the apple resting in his palm. Victor didn't even turn around.
What does it look like?
The words were dropped over his shoulder.
One lousy apple?
Here.
A half-eaten one was also tossed their way, landing chewed side down in the dirt.
"You can have that one, too."
Rudy was incensed.